Welcome back to the program. In November of 1989, the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War came to an end. We entered a period that some at the time thought was the end of history. Yet at the same time, it gave rise to a complacency, a lack of vision, a lack of imagination with respect to the future of U.S. foreign policy, internationalism, and global politics. All of that came to an abrupt end 12 years later on September 11, 2001. How did the events of those 12 years lead to 9/11, and how did it shape the world we live in today? It's the subject of an indispensable new history of that period. It is entitled America Between the Wars, from 11/9 to 9/11, the misunderstood years between the fall of the Berlin Wall and the start of the War on Terror. It is written by our guest this morning, James Goldgeier. He's a professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's authored or co-authored 4 books on foreign policy. He's written numerous articles for many publications, and he served at the State Department on the National Security Council staff. It is my pleasure to have James Goldgeier here to talk about his book, America Between the Wars, from 11/9 to 9/11. James Goldgeier, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. Was there any effort that ever went on, either in the State Department, the Defense Department, or the White House for that matter, during the period leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall, to talk about, to think about, to plan what the world might look like in a post-Cold War period?
There really wasn't, unfortunately, and that was one of the problems that we faced. I think there was a general sense that the Cold War was just a fact of life and we would be dealing with it forever. And so, unlike World War I and World War II, where, you know, early, in fact, in those wars, planning was already taking place for the post-war period. We just never did that kind of planning for the end of the Cold War, and so there was so much attention on the Cold War and even at the end of the Cold War and trying to have it turn out peacefully, but nobody was really prepared for, okay, well, now what do we do? What kinds of problems are we dealing with? What kind of world are we facing?
And how soon was it after the end of the Cold War, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that some of the fault lines that would really develop over this period would become clear? This debate between the U.S. as the sole superpower in the world, exercising that power, or the more Bush approach at the time, which was looking towards international cooperation and a new world order?
Well, I think there was a general sense that there was a tremendous opportunity for the United States, if it remained engaged in the world, to work through the international institutions that were the ones basically that we created after World War II and that we were still leading, to try to organize world affairs. But I would say there was a real difference from military to economic affairs. In military affairs, the real question was, well, what would you now use force for? If you didn't have this major enemy, the Soviet Union, why would you deploy American military forces elsewhere? And so we had huge debates about whether or not places like Bosnia and Somalia, Rwanda, Haiti, should we, shouldn't we use military force? The other issue, though, that people confronted, certainly Bill Clinton confronted early on and ran his campaign on in 1992, was the meaning of globalization, the sense that you no longer could distinguish between the domestic and the international economy. And, you know, now we take this for granted. But in 1992, this was a big idea that we really needed to reorganize our thinking to try to understand what the impact of globalization would be. And I think for somebody like Clinton and the people around him, that was easier for them to get their arms around than this notion of, well, we have military force, but when would we send Americans to die? What would be seen in the national interest? Something that we really didn't get into focus again until after September 11th.
But that idea of globalization was more than anything else an economic construct at the time, less of a foreign policy construct.
That's true. One of the things, though, that Clinton wanted to do was to try to raise the profile of economic issues in the conduct of foreign policy. And at the same time, certainly in think tanks at the time and some of the foundations like the MacArthur Foundation and others, they were starting to try to understand the new face of transnational challenges. Terrorism, people were already worrying about, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, pandemic disease. You know, certainly there was tremendous concern already at that time about the spread of HIV/AIDS. We weren't really talking a lot about bird flu yet, but there was a sense that we did need to redefine security, but that was largely happening outside the government. Inside the government, it was hard to reorganize away from a government that was focused on dealing with the big Soviet threat. That was really going to take quite a bit of time, both for the foreign policy community as well as the military community.
And to what extent were the events that were taking place in the Balkans and to a certain extent in other parts of the world, where we saw basically nations breaking apart as a result of the lessening of control from the Cold War?
Yeah, it was one of the ironic features of early in the Clinton presidency. He turned to his national security advisor, Anthony Lake, and said something to the effect of, you know, sometimes I really miss the Cold War, which, you know, we should never miss. We shouldn't miss the Cold War. But but the idea was that, well, there seemed to be some kind of order to that, and now there was just disorder. And, you know, how are we going to handle all this disorder, the failed states and the civil wars, you know, all these things that were kept suppressed by the U.S.-Soviet rivalry and the dominance. And as the U.S. And Russia sort of, you know, left the Cold War battlegrounds, all those places, including Afghanistan, of course, became the hotbeds of all sorts of other unforeseen problems.
And, of course, one of the ironies of this period, as you write about, is that we engaged more in military activity, that we were engaging in military activity on the order of once every 18 months.
It is ironic. I mean, here we were, we finished with the Cold War, we thought, okay, there'll be a peace dividend, we don't have any major enemies, and we were using military force all the time throughout the Clinton years. Certainly Bill Clinton, when he came into office in January 93, could not have expected that.
And then when Bush II came to office, you know, he ran on a platform almost of isolationism, although it turned out quite different.
Yeah, it's fascinating, you know, as we looked back at that 2000 campaign, just remembering that the discussion about foreign policy in the campaign, you know, the hawks, the interventionists, were Al Gore and Joe Lieberman on the Democratic side. They were the ones arguing we need to be out there doing more, we need to be doing things about Iraq, for example. And it was Bush and Cheney who were much more cautious about American involvement. Certainly they were quite opposed at the time to the notion that America should be engaged in nation building. And, of course, as we know, they engaged in major nation building during their time in office.
What might have happened differently during this 12-year period that could have changed the way American foreign policy was shaped and might have changed the look of the international world we live in today?
Well, it's a great question, and I think, you know, one of the problems looking back is it's easy to forget sort of how eager the American public was to really stop thinking about the rest of the world. You know, there really was this sense after the Cold War, you know, we should focus on things at home. We don't need to be as engaged as we were. And I think that there really was a major effort at the highest levels of the government to try to find ways to keep Americans understanding that we need to be engaged. But just two things, I guess I would say. One, when we spoke with Robert Rubin, who, you know, for the bulk of the Clinton presidency served as Secretary of Treasury, had also been head of his National Economic Council before that, he told us that he really felt that one of the things that he wished they had done early on was to lay out for the public sort of a multi-year project, an effort to help the public understand what globalization meant for the American economy and how we needed to adjust for that. And if you look even at Clinton's last major foreign policy speech in December 2000, he regrets not having really been able to explain as well as he had hoped what globalization would mean. And the other thing, of course, is the terrorism. In August of 1998, there was a memo from CIA Director George Tenet to his colleagues at the top of the government after the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, in which he basically used the words, "We are at war with Al-Qaeda." Now, of course, those of us who weren't in the government at the time, just, you know, living our normal lives, never had that sense that we were at war until after September 11th. And I think that was one of the real problems toward the end of the administration, and really because at the time that Tenet was trying to make this argument, and at the time that Clinton and others, his national security advisor Sandy Berger, understood that this threat was real, Clinton was battling the U.S. Congress over what he had done with Monica Lewinsky, and the public's attention was directed at that and not the issue of terrorism.
Was there talk about these issues in the capitals in Europe, among European Union members, and even in the nations of the former Soviet Union?
Well, really what you had in Europe at the time was a tremendous inward focus on building Europe. You have the European Union developing in the 1990s. You have the development of the single currency, the euro. You have the effort to try to start bringing the countries of the former Warsaw Pact, the Central and Eastern Europeans, into NATO and then the European Union. So you really have a Europe during those years that's very inwardly focused as they're trying to develop the European project.
And the former Soviet Russia and the former Soviet Union?
Well, Russia, you know, I mean, it's especially looking back, I mean, here we are in this period where Obama has proclaimed an effort to reset relations with Russia. And, you know, of course, we're all hopeful that we can develop better relations with Russia, especially after really the low points of the last couple years of the George W. Bush administration. But there were plenty of missed opportunities in the 1990s. There were real efforts to reach out to try to draw the Russians closer to the West, and the Russian leader at the time, Boris Yeltsin, was eager to do that, but there was also this tremendous backlash in Russia to what the West was doing vis-a-vis Central and Eastern Europe, trying to bring those countries closer to the West. There was a feeling that the West was humiliating Russia, that Russia, you know, Russia's interests weren't being respected, and that's taken a long time to overcome, and, you know, in some ways we still haven't overcome it, and you still have the mutual suspicion between the West and Russia over those issues in that fault line between West and East, and we saw that last summer with the war in Georgia.
How did these issues play out or evolve? Because it certainly wasn't static. How did they play out in terms of domestic politics regarding foreign policy during the 90s?
Well, the period was critical for both the Democratic and Republican parties and shaping those parties from the period of the end of the Cold War all the way to the present. If you look, for example, at the Republican Party, everyone's focused today on the problems of the party and the divisions within the party, seeming lack of leadership. And it's important to understand that on foreign policy, the Republicans have really been divided ever since the end of the Cold War. You had, during the Cold War, anti-communism was the glue that held the Republican Party together. And when communism collapses, so does anti-communism. So you have all sorts of factions developing, and those have continued to the present, and I believe will continue for some time in the future. You don't really have a natural theme the way we had with anti-communism for the Republicans to rally around. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, the end of the Cold War was a huge opportunity for a Democratic Party that had been seen as weak on national security, not tough enough on the communists, you know, really lost its way on national security after Vietnam, huge splits. And with the Cold War gone, you had an opportunity, for example, for somebody like Bill Clinton to become president. It couldn't have happened during the Cold War. He didn't have the kind of experience necessary. But and his efforts to move the Democratic Party toward the middle of the political spectrum. And, of course, now you have a president who, you know, owns the middle of the political spectrum, you know, a resounding victory last fall. And what's fascinating today is the Obama administration and its efforts to build the Democratic Party and this administration as a national security administration, a national security party, competence on these issues in ways that we haven't seen for the Democrats probably since the administration of John F. Kennedy. It's really quite a shift. The Republicans seem quite lost on foreign policy and national security issues, and they don't own those issues the way they did from, you know, the second half of the Cold War through the, you know, at least first part of the George W. Bush administration.
Do you think that's as a result of the fault lines that you were talking about before within the Republican Party, or is it personnel, or is there something else going on?
Well, I think there are a number of things that are going on. One is just that the administration of George W. Bush mishandled foreign policy so badly in so many areas that gave the Democrats an opportunity to take on the mantle of being more of a foreign policy and national security party. I think the other thing is that, unnoticed by many in the public, you had many individuals in the Democratic Party during the George W. Bush years trying to build up the Democratic Party's credentials on national security and try to move the party in a way in which it, in the Clinton years, you still had that sense among Democrats, always a sense that they were looking over their shoulder.
Uh-huh.
And not wanting to be perceived as weak, being, you know, charged with being weak by the Republicans. And you saw that even up till the 2004 election with John Kerry, this notion, oh, the Democrats need to have somebody who served in Vietnam.
And it
didn't work.
Yeah, I mean, you even saw echoes of it in the rhetoric of the Hillary Clinton primary campaign.
Yeah, a little bit, but you know, then you've got Barack Obama, and he was never seemingly afraid of the Republicans. The Republicans put up a national security candidate in John McCain, and when John McCain said to Barack Obama, "Let's debate national security policy," Obama didn't run from it. Obama said, "Let's do it," and you know, has tried to articulate a different way of approaching national security. Now, of course, much will rest on how he does. We have two wars going on. He's ramped up the effort in Afghanistan. How he does with that will go a long way toward, you know, us finding out sort of how the Democrats can do on these issues. And certainly his emphasis on engagement and multilateralism will have to bear fruit, or he will come under criticism once again from the Republicans.
During this 12-year period that you write about, what role did the existing international institutions play, the UN, NATO? I know you've written a lot about the expansion of NATO. How did these institutions play out during this period, and to what extent did they help in many ways feed into the power of and give rise to the neoconservatives?
Well, what you had, you know... It's a funny thing about the period, right? Because on the one hand, you could have expected, well, we had all these institutions, they were created for the Cold War, we can now get rid of them and start over. But life isn't like that. You have these institutions, and basically what we did is we tried to adapt them all. And we took institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and NATO and the UN and tried to adapt them for the new era, and in some cases we were successful and in others we weren't. With the UN, there was hope. George H.W. Bush, who's the only president to have served as ambassador to the United Nations previously, he hoped that the UN would become a major institution, that it could work the way it hadn't during the Cold War because of the problems with the U.S.-Soviet rivalry being the obstacle to UN functioning. But the UN wasn't really designed to deal with the kinds of failed state problems, civil wars, ethnic conflict, those kinds of issues that emerged in the 90s. And so you have a Clinton administration that wanted to work through the UN but became frustrated by it. And so, for example, when it came time to decide whether to use force to deal with the problems of Kosovo in 1999, Bill Clinton didn't go for UN authorization because he knew he wouldn't get it and used NATO instead. Meanwhile, NATO geared toward defending against the Soviet threat, well, you know, it's been trying to figure out what its purpose is ever since the end of the Cold War, and we see it today struggling in Afghanistan and real division within the alliance about whether or not it should be there and how it should be carrying out those activities. And just one final institution I'll mention is the International Monetary Fund, which in the 1990s was there, you know, expressing the Washington Consensus, telling other countries what they needed to do in order to get IMF funding, which was really about opening up their markets and creating more transparency and doing the things the United States was telling them to do. Well, you know, today, lectures by the United States to other countries on how to manage their economic affairs don't go over as well as they did in the 90s when it seemed like we knew what we were doing.
And it does seem that the failure of these international institutions in some way fed into the arguments of the growing neoconservative chorus at the time.
Well, yes, because what the neoconservatives were basically saying was, look, you know, the United States is so powerful, you know, it should be setting the direction for the world. It should be using that power to reshape world affairs, and it shouldn't let itself get bogged down by institutions like the United Nations. Now, you know, there's a lot of neoconservative support for institutions like NATO because that's an institution that is made up of democracies, and a number of neoconservatives have seen that institution as playing a role in which it could counter non-democracies. But no question that the neoconservatives were looking for the United States to use its power more to reshape the world. Things like regime change in Iraq became very important for the neoconservatives by the late 1990s. And, you know, I think we've all been humbled by the limits to American power. We know that the United States can't do everything in the world, and that while we have a great military, that we have the greatest military in the world, but there are limits to what we should be asking that military to do. And while we have the strongest economy in the world, we also, you know, can't afford to get overstretched. That, you know, we are suffering tremendously right now. Certainly, you know better than I in the state of California how difficult things are right now economically. So, I would say the last few years, if anything, should have humbled us in terms of sort of our own beliefs about sort of what we can accomplish by ourselves. And Secretary of State Clinton gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations yesterday in which she talked about this and said, you know, we know that we need to be engaged in the world, but we can't solve problems alone. We have to work with others. And the central challenge today is working with partners, not just states, but non-state actors around the world.
Going back to the beginnings of this period, when George H.W. Bush and Jim Baker talked about a new world order at the time, did they have a vision of what they saw?
Not really. It really was more about sort of making the old order work, and that was using the United Nations and other institutions that had been created to try to help build greater order in the world. But what was important about their notion was that the United States should lead by working through international institutions. And, of course, we saw in the first Gulf War, Jim Baker made this major effort to help build an international coalition to reverse the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. And, you know, that's something that between the time that Bush administration left office in 1993 and a new Bush administration came in 2001, you know, that notion of leadership through institutions certainly got lost, and we're seeing an administration today trying to recapture that idea.
The first Gulf War really was an opportunity, or that Bush administration saw it as an opportunity to build this post-Cold War coalition.
Yeah, there was this sense that we really could see the kind of cooperation internationally that hadn't been possible before, and certainly the fact that there was U.S.-Soviet cooperation in 1990 and 91, not just on that, but German unification, for example, was seen as a tremendous opportunity going forward. And one of the problems that we had at the time was that, you know, we were fooled a little bit by the Gulf War because it was a war that was sort of perfect for international cooperation. One state invaded another, and the international community said, wait a minute, you know, we're not going to allow that to happen, and banded together to seek to reverse that. But the problems of the 90s weren't like that. And you know, as you had these problems arising within states and the kinds of challenges the UN really wasn't built for, that's when you saw the difficulties of dealing with international cooperation and things, for example, like not doing something to stop the genocide in Rwanda that just, you know, seem inexplicable in retrospect.
Was 9/11 really the turning point in terms of these post-interwar years?
Well, what 9/11 did was really wake up the American public and others to understanding that the world really was a dangerous place, is a dangerous place, and that the United States really does need to be engaged. But if you look at the problems that we've been dealing with since 9/11, whether we're talking about North Korea, Iran, Iraq, terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, you know, all these things, they were already there in the 1990s. They were being debated at elite levels in the 1990s. The public wasn't paying too much attention. But what 9/11 did was help put these issues in sharper relief and help people understand that they needed to pay attention to them. But, of course, we still have these huge debates about the best way to deal with problems like Iran and North Korea, for example, that, you know, we've been debating now for quite some time.
Right. And it's interesting how quickly in the post-9/11 world positions hardened, that people had been thinking about these issues during this time, and positions hardened pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, 9/11 certainly was such a shock to the public, and, you know, the Bush administration's initial reaction, I think quite understandably, was, okay, we're at war with these guys. We need to go and kill them before they kill more of us. And there was a consensus at that time, of course, as they went on and decided that Iraq needed to be part of the equation, that's when you started to see the divisions reemerge. And it wasn't just that the Democrats grew skeptical about the war in Iraq. You also had tremendous divisions within the Republican Party about the wisdom of Iraq.
As globalization spread and China became a bigger and bigger player, how did that fit into this global equation?
Well, I think from a geostrategic standpoint, a traditional geostrategic standpoint, you know, the rise of Asia in general, the rise of China in particular, is really, you know, sort of made the major challenge for us in the coming decades. And this began to be seen at the end of the Cold War. In fact, if you asked people in the early 90s who worried about sort of threats from other countries, you know, what's the next likely thing to emerge similar to the Soviet Union, people would have said, well, you know, rising China, that's where the fault lines are going to be. But what we've seen is, of course, it's much more nuanced than that. We have a China and a United States that are very interdependent today economically. They depend on a healthy American economy for their own growth, and we depend on their financing our economy. So tremendous interdependence there. A set of what could be common interests in terms of counterterrorism, counterpiracy, counterproliferation, and so on. And I think that it's going to be very interesting going forward. We now have in the new administration a strategic and economic dialogue that's been established on the American side, co-chaired by Secretary of Treasury Geithner and Secretary of State Clinton, and that'll be the major forum for working the relationship with China. And it is an absolutely fascinating one, and one that, you know, really will shape many issues in the globe.
And finally, is that in fact the strategic landscape going forward, that there will be this tighter bond between the economic and the geopolitical in terms of U.S. foreign policy?
Well, I hope so. And again, Secretary Clinton mentioned this yesterday in her speech, in which she talked about the need for the State Department to become more engaged in economic issues, trade issues, that she argued, you know, trade and finance and so on, that these are foreign policy issues. One of the problems has been for the United States, however, that, you know, in terms of the training of our diplomats and others on the foreign policy side, is that, you know, they haven't spent as much time being trained in economic areas, having that kind of expertise and background, and so it's been very difficult to develop a stronger inner relationship. But, you know, we can't afford to continue to think about these things separately, and similarly, folks on the economic side, you know, have to have a greater awareness of national security issues so that, you know, they have greater sensitivity to the national security dimensions of the economic issues they work on.
James Goldgeier. The book is America Between the Wars, from 11/9 to 9/11. It's just out in paperback from Public Affairs Press. James, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you very much. Have a good day.
I appreciate it.